Not too far from where I am here in Los Angeles, Dean Martin used to come by and buy his hamburgers at a stand. And they always looked forward to seeing him drive up. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take your phone calls now. Full open lines with Charles Ospin on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Charles Ospin, our guest. Charles, what do you do next? I mean, do you travel much beyond, like, the Joshua Tree conference? What else do you do?
Joshua Tree is certainly lots of fun. In fact, I was there about 10, 12 years ago, and the Tegatron, which I only saw briefly, is sort of an interesting spot. I'll toss it out there. I actually do spend an awful lot of time looking at patents. I work with sometimes VCs and other groups of people who bring me into their situation in what's called due diligence, where I evaluate the technology in assessing its potential commercial value. And then other times I'm involved with things like the future maps and developing reports and looking at data and those kind of things. And then I have several other projects, one of which is a sort of a book project that's kind of brewing in the background. And maybe I'll mention that a bit later. And just it's a variety of things. But, yeah, I do travel sometimes. It just depends on what the current moment might be.
Let's go to the phones. First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George and Charles. Great program this morning.
Thanks.
I have a couple of issues that you covered 2 hours ago that I'd like to just have addressed. First of all,
sure.
I'd like to know what we as just regular American citizens can do to try and somehow get our politicians to realize that we're fighting a worthless war in Iraq. And I have a grandson who's been over there for a year and a half. He was at the Syrian border. In May of this year, he was moved to Ramadi. Since he's been there, first of all, I come from a very long line of military people, and we support our troops and our country. This is the first time that I have been just totally irate. I get calls from him on a weekly basis. Since he's been in Ramadi, they are mortared almost daily. When they when they go out on patrol, they rarely leave their trucks anymore, their vehicles, unless they absolutely have to, because when they go off base, they are bombarded with rocks and stones. People are yelling obscenities to them and saying, "Yankee, go home." He has seen several of his friends when they've been running in the barracks from one building to another, and I use building as a very light
lightly, yeah,
thing. Just totally being blown away. The stories are horrific. So, as an American citizen, it just seems like we're helpless. And when I hear that we're going in debt to China to be there at $2 billion a day.
Yeah, right.
The second question is how can that ever be repaid?
I get what you're saying. And first of all, let me just express that I have complete respect for those folks that volunteered. They put on the uniform. They really, in their patriotic sense, you know, in a very respectful way, you know, they signed up and thought this is the right thing to do. I feel strongly, though, that a lot of people were misled.
That's true.
And I, you know, it's a really strange thing because unlike the Vietnam War, where I think a lot of people were very bad in the sense that they kind of misjudged the soldiers, most of whom were drafted, actually, and, you know, treated them very badly, I feel we're sensing something very different now. We're not faulting the soldiers at all. But my heart really goes out to them. But I really have some agreements with you in the sense that I think this was a somewhat misguided policy. But in terms of the question, and I'm not sure what the answer is, but I think this coming November, you know, go to the polls and vote as you feel is your conscience. I think there's a lot of folks currently in Congress who know that something is about to change. I think they sense that. So I think they're hearing us. But my thought about China, here's where I might step in with a bit more concrete response. I have a theory about how this is working. It's just a theory, but I do have some data points which kind of support this concept. I'm suggesting that deals are made in the background. Everybody knows that we're essentially bankrupt unless we have some financial support. Saudi Arabia,
right,
number one, China, number two. I'm sorry, China's our first bidder, and then Saudi Arabia right behind it. So those are the two nation states that have provided most of the working capital that we now use to sort of stay afloat. There's a plan in mind. It's not that China's going to, like, call up and say, we have to pay the debt off tomorrow. That's not going to happen because that would crush our economy. That doesn't help them either. But what they do want, and this is where I think it's going to go, they've got their eyes on Taiwan. They're going to go for it. I can just, you know, I'll put $100 on the table. That's what's in their plan. So at a certain point, they're going to come to us kind of quietly and say, look, folks, here's how it really is. We've now got a blue navy. We've got a functioning space program. You know, if you really want to go toe-to-toe, you know, we can do that, but it'd be a pretty bad mess for everybody. Tell you what we're going to do. We'll kind of forgive some of the debt, you know, maybe extend some credit for the next half century. But, you know, we're going to take Taiwan, and we might decide to do some naval operations in the other areas of the Pacific, maybe, you know, Philippines or something, who knows, whatever they have in mind. But, I mean, I think that's kind of where it's going to go. They're going to extend their power into the Pacific region, and I think in the very long term, their ultimate goal is Japan. I think that, and that's, they're going to invade Japan, but they clearly want to kind of crush Japan's economy. You got to remember, this is a 5,000-year-old, you know, civilization. Their sense of time is very different than ours. For them to embark on a 10, 20, 50-year program is completely normal in the context of their culture. We're kind of the opposite. We kind of dart around from, you know, election period to election period. Yeah. And, you know, for people to try to plot out a future map based on our political system is a real challenge. I should know because I try to do this myself. Whereas in other cultures, it's an entirely different metric. And I think that short term, they're going to go for Taiwan. Long term, they're going to want to, in a sense, economically subjugate Japan, and they're going to want to be in control of the Pacific Rim region. I think that's what they're going for.
Next up, thanks, Charles, for that comment. West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hello there. Good morning.
Hey, I have a question. This is Charles from New Mexico. And before you talked about a 4-bit DNA like computer software program.
Well, no. I was making a metaphor, but your thinking is pretty much on the mark. Just think about it like this. In a traditional Pentium or, you know, garden variety computer chip or any digital logic that we're familiar with, it's ones and zeros. You have two numbers to work with. In a biological system where you have four specific protein types and they pair up in a very specific kind of way, you have a 4-bit numbering system. Essentially, it's the same general concept. It's just that you have more numbers to work with. But that's roughly the idea.
Okay, and I guess my question there does that suggest some sort of intelligent design, not just with the DNA structure, but actual molecules, the atoms themselves, and when you break it down to the quantum particles where laws of physics just falls apart and the physical reality is no longer there, it's just some sort of energy. Does that suggest some sort of perhaps matrix that we're in?
Well, you know, I kind of know where you're going, and in fact, you'll find this kind of humorous. I'm sure George will get a laugh out of this, but the two brothers that made the Matrix films, they actually, their whole studio setup was right here in the Bay Area. They're in Alameda, which is like just across the bay from here. And, you know, I kind of had some friends who were sort of connected to these guys in a strange way, but after the films were made, they actually produced a 5-DVD disc set, and believe it or not, if you go find this thing somewhere, one of the discs in there is called, The Science of the Matrix, and it's kind of interesting. I mean, they picked me out of 30 other people that they put on this. You know, it's a bunch of folks, myself included. I'm literally on there for 15 seconds. I mean, truly, it's 15 seconds of infamy. But I'm on there talking about this exact topic, you know, the science of the Matrix, you know, where does the quantum consciousness part leave off and the sort of physical reality begin? And I kind of sense where you're going with this. I two comments I might make. I'm very strongly interested in the kind of work that Dean Radin and Russell Targ and those folks are involved with. In fact, I've known these people for a long time, and I'm very closely sort of watching what they're doing, because I think another one of those endpoint transition thresholds is we're about to pry open the Pandora's box of trying to understand sort of the physics of consciousness. It's no longer a philosophical debate or maybe a religious kind of vision. It's more like, can we actually look at the physics and see how this works? And I think we're getting sort of close to that edge. But in the larger scheme of things, if I may, not to in any way downplay anyone's spiritual beliefs, because I have my own spiritual beliefs, I do believe there's some kind of a higher power, maybe a collection of entities that were sort of the top of the sort of food chain of entities, as it were. But, you know, something's out there beyond us. I'll just put it that way. And for those folks that either look out into the cosmos and look at the spectacular complexity, or for folks in my line of work who burrow down into the molecular level, the complexity, the order, the spectacular beauty of all these different systems, to just suggest it was some random mishmash that's somehow clumped together, the logic doesn't support that very strongly. there's something larger than us that made these things possible. That's the best answer I can come up with, but it's the one I really feel.
Do you think, you brought up something. Do you think synthetic biology will get us closer to God?
I think that our definition of what God is supposed to be, quote-unquote, and I say that very, very delicately, because I'm not in any way trying to denigrate someone's particular faith or church or synagogue, whatever it might be, but I think that we've been kind of trained, sort of, in a certain, maybe clumsy kind of way. A series of books and documents were written up, and part of it, I think, was bona fide spiritual message, and I think part of it was the workings of man to sort of create kind of political documents with, you know, religion sort of wrapped up in it. And we've been kind of conditioned to accept a kind of a narrow box-like vision of this is what God's supposed to be. And I think that's kind of where we've sort of gone wrong. In fact, if I can be so bold, a lot of our wars and conflicts in past and even current times, sadly, are kind of wrapped up in this mechanical vision of this is the way God's supposed to be. My little book says it has to be this way. No, everybody. That's where we're kind of going wrong. I would be willing to try to suggest that our next evolutionary stage, I think, should drive us to go beyond that limitation, that we should be able to look outside the little individual boxes of our definitions of God and see the larger, more holographic picture. I think that's what we're supposed to try to do. That's my sense of it.
Fast blast from Scott in Bloomington, Minnesota. Great show, George, but what the heck is that constant clicking sound? I'll let you answer that, Charles.
I don't know. I swear I even got a couple of emails, and I apologize profusely.
You don't hear it?
I don't hear it. I don't know what it's. You know, I live in a wooded area, kind of up here in the hills. I mean, it's like deer and antelope.
Yeah.
But, you know, deer and raccoons and squirrels kind of are my neighbors. So maybe it's just the phone lines are flaky.
Are you on a wireless phone?
No. Hard wire into the wall, you know, new phone, the whole bit. I honestly don't know what the deal is.
How strange.
And I'm truly sorry for that. I apologize to anyone's listening that may have to hear what I can't even hear myself, so I don't know.
East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, Mr. Norris.
Good morning, sir.
I'd like to apologize to Charles. I don't have a question for him, but I just like to let you know it's so hard to get to you about a website. I let your young lady know about it. It's very interesting. My brother does artwork out in Vancouver, BC. By the way, my name's Stuart from Toronto, and he has done a lot of conceptual artwork for nanotechnology and a space elevator that's actually been
proposed, sure.
Commissioned by Phoenix Mint and actually printed on a 1 ounce silver coin.
All right. You want us to go take a look at that, Stuart?
Yes, I think you would find it very interesting. He's done covers and artwork for a lot of the leading science fiction writers that are in Canada right now. And like I said, I'd just like to apologize to Charles. I won't take any more of your time.
Well, that's fine. Actually, a nano coin's kind of cool. I bet that's okay. I don't mind it. That's kind of fun, actually.
All right. Well, we'll look at the old website. If we like it, we'll pass it on to Lex or Sean or Dan Brady, who's filling in, and have them take a look at it. Let's go to our next wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Good morning.
Yes. Hello, George. My name is Jack. I'm calling from Dayton, Ohio.
Jack, hi.
My question for Charles is, I want to know if he's ever heard or read a book called The Footprints of God by Greg Iles.
Don't know it. Sorry.
Okay, well, I think you'd be very interested in it because the premise of the book deals with, I guess it could be fictional technology, but it may be on the horizon, according to popular science, a super MRI, which takes a map of the brain down to the molecular level. And it creates a neural model, which is then loaded into a crystal nanotube matrix computer with a crystal memory core. This core is then accessed by lasers, which pull up holographic memories in a quantum format.
Well, the reasoning's not bad. I mean, nobody's built this machine exactly, but the pieces sort of exist now. And what's interesting about science fiction, and I don't know the particular book, what's interesting about science fiction is a lot of the science, and in fact, oddly enough, I'm actually queried upon by science fiction authors from time to time. I've had this conversation before where they'll fly something by me, they'll show me a part of a manuscript or maybe a chapter I'll end, say, what do you think of this? You know, and I'll kind of give a comment or two. And in fact, that's how the Matrix Brother guys fetched me up. And a lot of times these guys are pretty smart. They may not be scientifically trained, but they have a really good sense of how to kind of look for things and kind of get the larger picture. So pieces of that puzzle are already in development. I mean the logic of it is not flawed. I think it's sort of roughly within range. I'll say this much. In terms of NMR camera technology, UCSD, by the way, San Diego, is a great site for this. They have one of the most prolific neural research labs in the world, and they truly have, I mean, really pushed the envelope far in terms of having people come in. I mean, there are other labs, but they really are like the pinnacle of this concept. People come in, they'll be given certain kinds of stimuli, they'll answer questions, they'll look at maybe different kinds of art and, you know, interact in different ways. And then in real time, a specially tuned version of an NMR camera will actually look at their brain, maybe not at the molecular level, but certainly down to individual neuronic clusters and the ganglia level, and actually right. map in real time what's going on. I mean, it's actually kind of gotten pretty close to that sense of where we're going. As far as the holographic computing sort of perspective, yes, there are folks who are developing optical, holographic, laser-readable holographic storage and computing components. You can't buy one in a store, but certainly the pieces of that puzzle are in the lab.
Right. Well, I have one more question, then I'll get off. Do you think that the human brain has quantum capability or capacity?
Absolutely.
Because the human brain functions on a highly parallel functionality.
You're 100% right, and in fact, the place to go, you may know this already, but for those that might want to look into this, I would suggest looking at Dr. Stuart Hameroff's research at the University of Arizona. Great place to start. But as Dean Radin will tell you, and you know, he's the expert more than I am, but I certainly agree with this reasoning that, you know, a lot of us material science guys back in the early days, you know, 25, 30 years ago, we just kind of assumed that, okay, just keep drilling down to smaller and smaller increments in space, and everything's going to kind of operate the same way. Well, not so fast. You know, scientists get a little carried away sometimes. We think we know what we're doing, but actually we don't. And, of course, as you might suspect, when we started approaching these sort of quasi-submolecular approaching atomic-scale interactions, we discovered things are happening that we didn't really expect. And, in fact, you begin to observe quantum entanglement-like activities. And there are, in fact, certain biomolecular systems which are beginning to show evidence of this behavior. Some are the microtubulin systems that are found surrounding neurons. There's also a type of protein material called rhodopsins, which are found in the fovea of the eye, and other things which kind of suggest that there really could be a quantum interaction at that level. So it's not a completely erroneous way to look at it.
Okay, well, stick with us. We're going to be back with final phone calls in just a moment with our special guest, Charles Ostman. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. Always simple. I get them all. Charles has a couple of websites, historianofthefuture.com, globalcleantech.net. Both of those websites are linked up as well at coasttocoastam.com. We continue to monitor the situation with the space shuttle Atlantis as well. The go or no go for the burn is coming up really fast. So far, everything is good. The T-38 astronauts have radioed up that it was a beautiful night at the Cape, the best for a night landing possible, they say. So that's good news as well. Take a few moments, say a little prayer for those astronauts. They are due to touch down in about less than 2 hours now. I believe that is coming up very quickly, 4:28. Yep, less than 2 hours. We'll be back. Well, it's off to the cage tomorrow in St. Louis. Did I say the cage? The cave. And then Friday, it's the OnStar Studios in Detroit. Book signing, 1 o'clock Saturday at the Borders store at Novi, Michigan, on Crescent Boulevard, if you want to go out there and really enjoy that. And then I'll be back in St. Louis for about 10 days before I head back to Los Angeles. Lots to work on when we come back, including the pilot program for the Sci-Fi Cable Network, because they are getting hot and heavy to get that thing on the air. So things are looking good on that front as well. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Final segment, Charles Ostman, our guest. Charles, thanks for hanging around so
much. Oh, absolutely. My pleasure.
Let's move next to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Hello, Charles.
Yes.
I'm Dan from Kansas City. I have a question regarding consciousness and unconsciousness.
Okay.
And I thought about this. My thoughts are an embryo at the time of conception. I'm not talking about soul transfer here. I'm talking about past memories. Hmm. Seems to me like an embryo at the time of conception, an infant, would become would have a potential past connection to their past memories at that particular point in time. Hmm. And when that infant came into the light, was born, it would become conscious. Do you have any thoughts on that particular subject?
That is asking for the wisdom of God.
I'm
just a mortal, you know, science guy. I have some random thoughts, but I don't know if they're qualified or not. I mean, this is the $64,000 question, and kind of where this leads off to is in kind of a weird direction. But bear with me for a minute. This might help shed some light on the thought. There's a bunch of folks who I'm very familiar with, and myself included, have interacted with the genre of thought for quite some time. There is a theory that at some certain point there would be emergent synthetic sentience, or like emergent intelligence popping up out of a system that had this certain level of complexity and perhaps a neural network like configuration that could mimic something that resembled a life form. And a lot of people have debated. In fact, Ray Kurzweil himself, who found the Singularity Institute, has quite vociferously sort of, you know, yes, sorry, I don't know what's on the phone. Sorry about that. And the basic concept is this. What is consciousness? Is it the manifestation of self-awareness, or is it something that goes beyond the physical containment vessel that consciousness is sort of residing in? I think that's kind of what you're trying to lean towards. That's my interpretation of what you're trying to ask.
Well, what I'm saying is soul consciousness and unconsciousness, in my thoughts, would be they actually are energy, and they develop at the time of conception.
Hmm.
And consciousness becomes, you become aware of consciousness when the infant is born and comes into the light.
Mm-hmm.
So really you have an energy spark that would spark unconsciousness and soul consciousness. And this, at this particular point, I would think the infant would have a connection to all of its past, ancestral past.
It's possible. I'm just not qualified. You know, I'm not qualified to render an answer. That may be more of a theological question, quite honestly. But from my perspective, I'll grant you this. I think that there's a lot to be said for past lives, reincarnation. I kind of lean in that direction. It's just an intuition on my part. But what actually happens when conception happens, and how far into the gestation period before that becomes part of the process? I really have no idea. But I think it's an interesting question.
Charles, if we stopped synthetic biology research right now, are we any worse off than where we were?
It would make no difference, and let me explain why. And let me give a little bit of a caveat. As I may have said the last time I was on the air, I've been to Washington, D.C. a number of times. You asked before, do I travel? And I kind of didn't really answer very much. But, yeah, I do travel quite a bit, actually. And Washington, D.C. is one of the places I go to. And in one occasion in particular, I spent about 2.5-3 hours addressing the FDA. This was about 2 years ago, and they were looking for potential sort of guidelines for regulatory aspects of how to look at nanomedical applications. You know, what is it, a chemical, is it a device, you know, yes,
mm-hmm,
or no.
Right, good point.
Okay, so kind of in that context, it kind of opens up a much broader Pandora's box that, you know, the answer I eventually gave them after all this sort of technical stuff and lots of slides, I said, look, guys, whatever you folks decide to do here, it's relevant maybe for the jurisdictions of your political, you know, concern, but outside the boundaries of this country, it's a whole different ballpark. If you go to Australia, Taiwan, Japan, China for sure, India, you know, I mean, even parts of Europe, the regulatory process is completely different than what it is here. So whatever you or I might decide, well, let's pull the plug on synthetic biology at this moment, which I think would be a bad idea, by the way, it's not going to make any difference because it's simply going to sprout up in 40 other places around the world. There's no way to contain it. We have to, as American citizens, and I say this with great respect, we've been kind of America-centric somewhat in our vision of the world and how the you know, we try to regulate what the world does. We're not really in that position anymore. We really have to take a much more global perspective. So I think to answer that kind of a question, realistically, from my point of view, you kind of have to look at the sort of geopolitical processes that are involved, and it's different now than what it was in the past.
First-time caller line, you're up with Charles Ostman. Hi there. Hello.
Hi, this is Mercedes.
Calling. Hi, Mercedes.
From the Cincinnati area.
Sure.
And good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for a, I guess I could say a wonderful show, certainly very thought-provoking. I am calling not with a question, but with a suggestion. At times, it feels to me as if the trade-off for being intelligently and well-informed can lead to moments of great despair.
You can. Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
And I sometimes fear that we will not survive our evolutionary adolescence. And in those moments of great despair, there is a book called A Last Babylon. I'm terrible with authors' names, but it's two first names. It's either Herbert Frank or Frank Herbert is the name of the author.
Well, Frank Herbert's a very famous science fiction author, so that may be the case.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a book that was written about 30 years ago. I've been reading it for off and on for about 30 years. And it's a small book. It is not a tome. And it is just, it's a book that speaks to the extraordinary resilience of the human spirit. It's pre and post nuclear war story about this enclave in Florida that manages to survive. Those of whom have lived manage to survive and garner their various talents and gifts and skills to create a new world, essentially, and go on. And I don't have my own particular brilliance to add to the show. And in lieu of that, this is one of my Bibles, sort of. It is a book to which I go again, for reassurance, and I think of it particularly earlier, several hours earlier, when you all were talking about the possibility of nuclear war. I think anything that we can have in our sort of own personal arsenal, spiritual, intellectual, psychological, that can give us hope is part of what keeps us going.
I couldn't agree more. I would chime in and say that the link between state of mind and state of physical world is much stronger. Hello? Hello?
Oh, sorry, I don't know where she went.
I don't know. Okay. The link between state of mind and the physical world is much more robust than I think a lot of us in the modern world sort of get credit for. I think this is a lot of what the ancient cultures were very much in tune with, and we're sort of trying to remember that as we speak. And, you know, a kind of a larger thought. I mean, just like I was saying in the first part of the program,
it was Pat Frank, by the way.
Okay, very good. Because she mentioned Frank Herbert, and so I wasn't sure what it was.
Pat Frank.
But the point is, yeah, I too get frustrated. I mean, you know, I work in these sort of complex scenario modeling schemes all the time, and I see stuff that would crush the spirit out of a lot of people. They would just go, why even bother? But I suggest to you that we are part of a larger design strategy. And that might be kind of a tricky choice of words, but I think that life forms such as us and on many other worlds, we are supposed to, in a sense, go through a series of evolutionary, maybe trauma cycles or sort of challenges, and to which we respond. And if we have the wisdom to sort of understand the larger picture, then we sort of graduate to the next stage. And if we don't, then maybe it's appropriate that the life form in question kind of gets reset to a, you know, starting all over kind of position. I mean, I take a kind of a larger view. I think that we are, however, at a critical mass threshold point, that we really are within the edge of a kind of an event horizon. And I'm not without hope, but I am certainly with awareness that the scale and the velocity of the transition is something really to be appreciated that we're approaching.
All right, next up, Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
George.
Yes.
This is Jeff calling from Beijing, China.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
First-time caller. I'm doing well, and I have a question and then a comment to your guest. And I would like to know, when was the last time that you've actually come here to China?
I never have. And if I said anything that was offensive to you or any of your compatriots in China, I did not mean that in any way. It was just one particular vision that was held by a certain kind of geopolitical perspective, and it was not meant to be offensive in any way.
You know, I've been coming here for 8 years. I am the only American in senior management working for the central government of China. in fact, met with the minister of the CAAC, which controls all the airlines, last Monday in his private VIP office. You don't know what's happening here. You cannot imagine the openness and freedom that has descended upon this country. It is not democratic, nor does it want to be. It is China. But the openness that Deng Xiaoping brought in the early 1970s, when it said it is good to be rich and capitalism has come in, you cannot believe the transformation of this society. And, George, you should have me as a guest because you cannot imagine the changes that are going on.
I'll do that. When do you come back to the States?
Well, I'm here in China for the rest of, to the middle of October. And then I'll be in for about 3 weeks and then come back
all
again
right.
to China.
Contact me by email and we'll see what we can do for you.
I will, sir.
And us.
But I know time is short, but I want to make this point.
No, please do. Please.
The transformation of capitalism is converting everyone all at once.
Okay.
From poor to rich, everyone is converting into the ultimate consumer.
You that I would agree with. I mean, in different degrees, but yeah, that's one of the transitions we witnessed. I agree with that.
And what is happening is the dragon is asleep. In fact, the dragon is not asleep. It's drugged. It's fat, dumb, and happy. It's sitting in the corner counting all the money. In fact, all the treasury bills that the Americans have, right?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, yeah. No, we can talk about that. Certainly we can.
You know, and I don't think that Taiwan and Japan are necessarily an issue because those evolutionarily will take care of themselves. When the world comes here in 680-some days for the Olympic Games, they will be wowed. And it's not about big buildings and about beautiful landscape. It's about the transformation of the people.
Sure.
And what Deng Xiaoping has done is unlocked the freedom and creativity of the individual. True, they don't get the vote, but how many Americans get the vote? How many Americans really participate in our political society? So leaving politics aside, if you think about the opportunities that the local businessman has, they can go from nothing to multimillionaire, and I have personal examples of this that I've worked for here in Guangzhou, China as well, that has transformed people's lives. When you think of China, we think of them like a horse with blinders on. We go down one narrow pathway. We only see China the way we want to see China. And what's happening here is unlocking a billion people. They can now travel wherever they want to. 5 years ago, they
only had... Well, with some exceptions, but I'll grant you like 80% of that view. I might go with that.
You only had a passport good one way from point A to B 5 years ago. Now a businessman, not only does he have a passport good for 5 years, he's part of the largest frequent flyer programs of the airlines of China. He now is using his FFP miles to take mom and dad with him to Saipan.
I know lots of entrepreneurs who are extremely much in your camp, and I'm going to be really, really careful because I have a lot of compatriots here at UC Berkeley who are from China, and I do have a sense of what some of this.
Well, Jeff, do you ever see a confrontation ahead between China and the United States militarily?
Only if we do something stupid like get in their way of Taiwan. The Taiwan issue is between the islanders and the mainlanders. If we stick our nose in, we're going to get it punched.
That I would agree with.
But if China uses force, then we might have to stick our nose in there.
And by the time they use force, it'll be over. It will be over. What are you going to do when they take over the island? It's done. You're going to ask them to take it back? And they said, sure, we'll just cash in all your treasury bills. And your country can go.
So what are they waiting for then?
What will happen is a natural evolution between the island and the mainlanders. There are billions invested from Taiwanese businesses on the mainland. What we don't see, and your comment is correct to your guest, we don't look at it from the long term. The Chinese do look at it from decades.
Absolutely.
And you are correct in saying that. And what's going to happen over decades is the natural blending of the two. Just like Hong Kong. Hong Kong is not part of Britain. It's part of China, but it's a special autonomous region.
Well,
and eventually that will happen.
I might offer two comments, and I really appreciate your wisdom. I completely respect where you're coming from, and I say this with a great deal of care. Just a couple of quick thoughts, and one caveat. Recently here at UC Berkeley, there was the first ever China/US joint climate change conference, and it was a really interesting event because It was a mix of business people, investors, people taking a very, very serious and very sincere look at how they could have a cleaner approach to their energy program. I mean, it was a very interesting mix of folks, and I have a lot of people in that kind of genre of thought. And so you're right that a lot of people here have a kind of a one-dimensional vision of the Chinese sense of what's going on. But there are a couple of difficulties, and I ask you this because I would like to hear your response. One is the Falun Gong. What do you think of that situation? And in the case of Tibet, which time passed was a pretty rough moment, I think your sense of a evolutionary symbiosis probably will be the result of Tibet, but they've kind of gone about it in a rather harsh way. But that's a couple of data points. I thought you might have a comment, if you wish, on that.
The people in Falun Gong did something galactically stupid. They challenged the government.
Well, this is true. I will grant you that.
As soon as they did that, and 10,000 people locked arms on a Saturday afternoon around a daka of one of the power people of the government, that was their recipe for death.
It was not a wise choice, and I would agree maybe a more diplomatic approach could have been considered. I'm interested to hear your response, and so I'm listening carefully.
And we've got about a minute left, and we're all done.
It's really cool. You definitely have to call me and put me on. But, you know, I think that you have to remember this comment. Hmm. You hear it everywhere here. China is China.
Yes, that's true.
You have to be patient.
Sure.
You have to be long-suffering. Okay. It's took me the first 4 years to break into the upper management of the airline that I represent. Mm. And then I've spent the next 4 years as the only American in senior management, and I have seen what's happening from the inside.
Okay.
And we look at it again as the horse with blinders. You're not really seeing what's happening here. If you leave the Chinese alone, they will be more than capitalist and more free than we are. But we don't see it. We only see short view, not long view.
One thing I might agree with you on, we have a proclivity for trying to invent enemies to suit a convenient moment in time. I'll walk you through that far. I would certainly offer you that.
Charles, the clock is going to get us, but I want to thank you and anyone who wants to look at Charles's websites, two of them, they're linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Charles, thank you, my friend.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
Appreciate you being part of the program. I will be in St. Louis tomorrow. The program originates out of the cave. And then I'm in Detroit at the OnStar Studios on Friday. And then we've got the book signing again at the Border Store at 1 p.m. in Novi, Michigan on Crescent Avenue. So if you're out in that area, Windsor, Detroit area, come on by. Love to talk with you for a while. We'll be there for a couple hours. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Jessica Spaulding, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Dan Brady, Ross Mitchell, I've gone way over budget this week, Ian Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.